The dynasty of Al-Adarisa are viewed as the first ruling authority of Morocco's Islamic history, and their story begins with the exile of a young Muslim man from Hijaz in present-day Saudi Arabia, Idris ibn Abdullah. The story of Idris I or Mullah Idris al-Akbar begins at a time when the lands that would become a portion of present-day Morocco were on the cusp of so much change, though largely un-Islamized. Idris was born into a family whose bloodline carried immense significance for the Muslim world. He was a Sharif, meaning he was a direct descendant of the Prophet والسلام, through the branches of his daughter Fatima Zahra and her husband Ali, the fourth caliph of Islam. Now, if you know anything about this couple, you know how legendary, mythical their life and their love story is, one of my favorites, and it certainly gave the persona of Idris a lot of substance. Ali and Fatima had two sons, Hassan and Hussein, and Idris al-Awwal came from the Hassanid branch. The world he was born into was one of division. After the death of the Prophet ﷺ in 632, disputes over leadership began to split the early Muslim community, which had blossomed during his life. The dynasty of the Banu Umayyah had ruled over the Muslim world from Dimashq, followed by al-Abbasiyin, who overthrew them in 750. The Abbasiyin were widely accepted in the beginning, but they also faced a lot of opposition from various groups, particularly the branch that was descending from Ali. These factions believed that they were the rightful leaders of the Muslim world, since the blood of the Prophet ﷺ was running through their veins. One such moment of opposition was the infamous deadly Battle of Fakh in 786, a bloody but decisive clash that took place near Mecca in present-day Saudi Arabia between the forces of al-Abbasiyin and the quote-unquote rebels from Ali's family, also known as Ahlul Bayt. They were once allies of the Abbasiyin themselves, and that's essentially when they overthrew the Banu Umayyah. However, as soon as the Abbasiyin secured their power in the region, they turned on their former friends. They wanted to kill in the nest any potential claims to leadership that could legitimately come from the family of the Prophet ﷺ. So, where is Idris ibn Abdullah in this picture? Well, the future founder of the first Moroccan Islamic state stood amongst the ranks of his nephew or uncle, depending on the source, Hussein, during the Battle of Fakh, which again marked a turning point in the conflict as it meant the victory of al-Abbasiyin. Following through with their bloody success, al-Abbasiyin massacred the family of Idris ibn Abdullah. The rebellion was crushed and many descendants of Ali were killed. Idris ibn Abdullah was still very young when that happened and nearly lost his life, but he managed to escape the battlefield by joining a group of pilgrims who were fleeing far away from the watchful eyes and deadly swords of the Arab dynasty. And that is what led Idris ibn Abdullah to set foot on the African continent. After escaping the chaos, Idris ibn Abdullah started his journey of exile with, we can assume, a heavy heart, leaving behind him the shadows of a painful past tainted with loss. Idris started a journey that would change not only his life, but the course of history forever. Perhaps he wasn't just running away from danger, but was rather inhabited by the strategic knowledge that his claimed prophetic lineage destined him to something greater than the chaos that he witnessed as a child in Hijaz. In his new home, wherever it might be, he was seeking three things: shelter, support, and purpose. Idris ibn Abdullah crossed the Red Sea. From there, he eventually made his way to Abyssinia, which is located in modern-day Ethiopia. Get your map, everyone. And the thing about this region at the time is, it was commonly known for providing sanctuary to the people that had been persecuted in the Arabian Peninsula.
Like I said, chaotic times for Arabs.
From Abyssinia, he headed north to Egypt. And mind you, Egypt at the time was still under the control of al-Abbasiyin. Thankfully, it wasn't as tightly gripped to the caliphate as more central territories were. The travels of Idris ibn Abdullah eventually brought him to the western Maghrib region in modern-day Morocco. Fortunately, he had his loyal servant, Rashid, by his side. Rashid had been freed from slavery, and his loyalty to Idris was so unwavering that he would continue to serve the dynasty of Al-Adarisa years after his master's death. Together, they survived the reckonings of the desert, walked for days on end on the rockiest soils, muscled through sleepless nights. Their journey came to an end, a couple kilometers away from the Atlantic Ocean. They settled in Zarhon, between present-day Fez and Meknes. Thankfully, one of the two men figured it would be wise to take a couple additional steps, which eventually led them to their final destination, the ancient Roman city of Walili. Little did they know what that chapter had in store for them. It is 788. By that point, the city of Walili had been the shelter of an Amazigh tribe for years, one of the greatest of the 8th century, according to 14th century historian Ibn Khaldun. The Awraba. The Awraba were known for having held their ground against the Arab troops of the Banu Umayyah Caliphate, who raided through North Africa starting the 7th century. For years on end, they resisted everything that had to do with the Arabs, including Islam. They were proud, headstrong, and valued their independence. But upon Idris's arrival, the leader of the Awraba, Ishaq bin Muhammad bin Hamid al-Awrabi, saw the potential behind the men, and most importantly, the many ways in which he could make his tribe great again. At this point in the episode, I think we need to zoom in and browse through the storybook of the Awraba. The Awraba tribe were pre-Islamically located in present-day Western Algeria. They are considered to be the descendants of ancient Numidians who resisted Roman and Byzantine domination. Fast forward to the 7th century during the Muslim conquest of North Africa. Here again, the Awraba resisted the Arab expansion under the leadership of their king, Kusaylah. And it was during his rule that the Awraba experienced their golden age. However, after his defeat and death, the influence of the Awraba began to shift as they ended up embracing Islam, fading away and moving further west into Morocco. Let's go back to 788. As a leader, Ishaq was naturally seeking power and quite obviously had an eye for opportunity. He noticed that Idris ibn Abdullah was probably more than just a man on the run. He realized that this fugitive, a descendant of the Prophet ﷺ, had a legitimacy to him, something that could speak to the few local tribes that had already embraced Islam with the relatively recent Arab invasions. Ishaq knew the Maghrib region wasn't a unit, far from that. It was torn between rival confederacies of tribes, but also starting to transform with the Muslim conquests. Though Islam actually took a while to really settle in North Africa. Let's travel back again, even further in time, so you actually understand what I mean by the Maghrib region wasn't the most peaceful place to be at the time. When Islam had technically arrived in the region with the Arabs in the 7th century, local Amazigh tribes had not fully embraced the new religion. Matter of fact, like we just said, historians agree to say that the religion took quite some time to settle in North Africa, centuries. Many tribes still followed their own beliefs, while a handful had been converted to Christianity or Judaism a while back. A few Amazigh noblesmen had converted to Kharijism, an Islamic school of thought, if you will, that opposed the mainstream Sunni rulers, particularly the Banu Umayyah and later the Abbasiyin. The Imazighan people had also grown very hostile towards Arab rulers, and understandably so, right? Earlier Arab attempts to impose Islamic rule had been met with the greatest resistance, most notably during the Great Berber Revolt between 740 and 743. Under the rule of the Banu Umayyah elite, Amazigh tribes had enough. They were frustrated by the inequality and the heavy taxation they were facing, so they decided to rally behind a leader, Maysara al-Matghari. And here's what Ibn Khaldun had to say about that very tumultuous time. And I quote, "The acts of oppression and tyranny of the Banu Umayyah having finally become unbearable, the Imazighin gave in to the instigations of Maysara. In the year 740, they killed Umar bin Abdullah, governor of Tanja. The fire of the revolt spread immediately through the Maghrib region and to such an extent that the Khalifa of the East could no longer enforce their authority there." End of quote. Maysara formed an alliance with the tribes of Ghumaram, Knasa, and Barghouta. Together, they successfully pushed away the troops that were coming from Andalus in present-day Spain to help the Arabs. Maysara then declared himself caliph before he was mysteriously assassinated by his own men. The rebellion continued after his death. Let's go back to the Awraba. Faced with that reality of a chaotic tribal network of alliances in the mind of Ishaq, Idris had the potential to unite people under a single Islamic ruler, and most importantly, under his tribe's administration. Idris ibn Abdullah, on his end, was quick to understand the opportunity and the significance of the support that he was being shown by Ishaq. The Awraba were big in the region, with a centuries-old influence that stretched all the way across North Africa. And the fact they had welcomed him with such open arms likely emboldened him to take on more ambitious pursuits. With their backing and Ishaq as his guide, Idris ibn Abdullah started to rally Amazigh tribes who had long felt disconnected from the Eastern Caliphates. Because yes, though the land was still very much independent and still fighting the Arab invasions at the time, some Middle Eastern troops had effectively established themselves in parts of the territory. Idris, though being an Arab himself, brought with him the idea of an Islamic state that could rise from their midst, an Islam that wasn't imposed by foreign powers that knew nothing of North Africa when they came, but rather that is led by someone who had become an integrate part of a local tribe and who seemingly shared their struggles and their vision. This alliance between Idris and Ishaq al-Awrabi was the cornerstone upon which the new Islamic state of Morocco would be built. Soon enough, word spread across the region, as it does so well, of a Sharif who was young and had arrived in Walili. It worked. Tribes were either taking his side, folding by force, or resisting still, especially in the regions of Temsna and Tedla in present-day Morocco. His reputation grew, and so did his reach. With his new allies, Idris began to gather a small army. Together, him and Ishaq traveled from village to village. Ishaq used his knowledge of the local customs to connect with Amazigh people. His charisma and Idris's vision, or the opposite, spoke to many. Soon, people were rallying in numbers behind them. They recognized his claim as an imam. And don't be fooled, being an imam back then was more than just a religious function. It was a political title that was kind of like a shortcut for Islamic governance and a free ticket to the hearts of believers. Idris ibn Abdullah built a persona in the eyes of people. His aura was enhanced by al-baraka, a perceived divine blessing, if you will. In 789, Idris began to consolidate his power. However, one thing needs to be said about the actual extent of his control over the region. It still is a matter of debate. Sources claim that he led many successful military campaigns, extended his influence over the valley of Wirgha, but we're not entirely sure. Historians still think it was significant as it still saw the minting of coins, one of the most powerful symbols of sovereignty and legitimacy. What that means essentially is currency was being fabricated, created in his name, in the cities of Walili and Toudra, which means his authority in those parts of the territory wasn't up for discussion. While Idris I was establishing himself in the far west of the Islamic world, again far away from the reach of the caliphs in Baghdad, the least we can say is that his success didn't go unnoticed. His influence in the region was growing, and let's not forget his claimed unfair advantage of being a descendant of the Prophet ﷺ. That claim alone made him a potential threat to the Caliphate of Al-Abbasiyyin, which did not have that holy, sacred argument to assert their legitimacy. Naturally, Harun al-Rashid, the Caliph of Al-Abbasiyyin at the time, saw Idris as a challenge to his own authority. You guessed it. In 791 or 793, the reign of Mullah Idris al-Akbar came to a tragic and quite unexpected end. According to historical accounts, Harun al-Rashid couldn't contain his animosity towards him any further. The threat that Idris ibn Abdullah represented was too in front of his face. And you know what they say, all's fair in love and war, and especially when you're a caliph. So, Harun al-Rashid called upon one of his viziers, al-Barmaki, and demanded that he got rid of Idris ibn Abdullah for him. The vizier took matters into his own hands, brought one of his most trusted men, Sulayman, and commanded him to eliminate Idris al-Akbar. Sulayman traveled all the way from Hijaz to Morocco and disguised himself as a loyal servant. Slowly but surely, the assassin won the trust of Idris al-Akbar, but also that of Rashid, who, like we mentioned earlier, had been his protector, his shield, ever since he first set foot on North African soil. For days on end, Sulayman kept his head low, noting every detail, every weakness, every person that surrounded Idris and who could potentially be an obstacle to his mission. While he was dining at his table, Sulayman plotted the perfect moment to execute his task. And one day, the opportunity just came. Sulayman had acquired a poison from a herbalist, probably in the market somewhere. He poured a couple drops of the poison in the food or the beverage, or maybe even the clothes of Idris al-Akbar, who knows. But the result remains. The condition of Idris I worsened with time. What is certain is that he died a young man, as he ruled for just over 3.5 years. To this day, the exact year of his passing remains a mystery. While we cannot say with chest when he died, we know for a fact when he no longer lived. In fact, the last sign of life Idris ibn Abdullah left in the historical record was upon his return from Tlemcen, where he had just won a victory and built a mosque in 791. After that, he completely went off the radar, sight unseen, and over time, fewer and fewer coins were minted with his name on them, which solidifies our belief that he effectively died in 791. When he died, Idris al-Awwal left behind his pregnant wife, Kinza, which meant that his legacy was far from being over. Kinza gave birth to a son, Idris II, who would continue his father's mission and further cement the foundations of the Moroccan state. After the death of Mullah Idris al-Akbar, remember his loyal servant Rashid, who had just, you know, brought him to the Maghreb region? Well, he took on the role of regent and protected the infant Idris II with his life until the kid was old enough to rule. Under Idris II, the city of Fez, one of Morocco's most iconic cities, would really begin to form and flourish. Idris al-Akbar is located in Moulay Idris Zerhon, his first settlement in Morocco. It became a site of pilgrimage for centuries, not only for his status as the founder of the first Islamic Moroccan state, but also, and most importantly, for his prophetic lineage. Each year, the Mosim, a religious festival in honor of Idris I, continues to draw thousands of Moroccans to commemorate the man behind the first Muslim dynasty of Morocco, Al-Adarisa, which built the foundations of a self-administrated state.